But, oh, it's not bad. And I would have taken it if you didn't have any money, like you said. But you've got plenty. Why do you throw your cash around for people to see if you want them to think you're broke? The other customers, sobered and thrilled by the sight of the gold, vigorously nodded their agreement. Musashi, recognizing the futility of arguing that the money was not his, took out a piece of silver and handed it to the man. "This is far too much, sir," complained the proprietor. "Don't you have anything smaller?" A cursory examination revealed some variation in the worth of the pieces, but nothing less valuable. "Don't worry about the change," Musashi said. "You can keep it." No longer able to maintain the fiction that the money didn't exist, Musashi tucked the pouch into his stomach wrapper for safekeeping. Then, despite urgings to linger a while, he shouldered his pack and went out into the night. Having eaten and restored his strength, he calculated that he could make it to Daimon Pass by sunrise. By day, he would have seen around him an abundance of highland flowers, rhododendrons, gentians, wild chrysanthemums, but at night, there in the immense sea of darkness, he could see only a cotton-like mist clinging to the earth. He was about 2 miles from the tea house when one of the men he'd seen there hailed him, saying, "Wait! You forgot something!" Catching up with Musashi, the man puffed. "My, you walk fast! After you left, I found this money, so I brought it to you. It must be yours." He held out a piece of silver, which Musashi refused, saying it certainly wasn't his. The man insisted that it was. "It must have rolled into the corner when you dropped your money pouch." Not having counted the money, Musashi was in no position to prove the man wrong. With a word of thanks, he took the silver and put it in his kimono sleeve. Yet for some reason, he found himself unmoved by this display of honesty. Though the man's errand had been completed, he fell in alongside Musashi and began making small talk.
"Perhaps I shouldn't ask, but are you studying swordsmanship under a well-known teacher?"
"No, I use my own style." The perfunctory answer failed to discourage the man, who declared that he had been a samurai himself, adding,
"But for the time being, I'm reduced to living here in the mountains."
"Is that so?"
"Those two back there, too. We were all samurai. Now we make our living cutting trees and gathering herbs. We're like the proverbial dragon biding its time in a pond. I can't pretend to be Sano Genzaimon, but when the time comes, I'll grab my old sword and put on my threadbare armor and go fight for some famous daimyo. I'm just waiting for that day to come."
"Are you for Osaka or Edo?"
"Doesn't matter. The main thing is to be on somebody's side, or else I'll waste my life hanging around here."
Musashi laughed politely. "Thanks for bringing the money." Then, in an effort to lose the man, he started taking long, rapid strides. The man stayed right beside him, step for step. He also kept pressing in on Musashi's left side, an encroachment that any experienced swordsman would regard as suspicious. Rather than reveal his wariness, however, Musashi did nothing to protect his left side, leaving it wide open. The man became increasingly friendly.
"May I make a suggestion? If you'd like, why don't you come spend the night at our place? After Wada Pass, you've still got Daimon ahead of you. You might make it by morning, but it's very steep. A difficult road for a man not familiar with these parts."
"Thanks. I think I'll take you up on that."
"You should, you should. Only thing is, we don't have anything to offer in the way of food or entertainment."
"I'd be happy to have a place to lie down. Where is your house?"
"About a half mile off to the left and a little higher up."
"You really are deep in the mountains, aren't you?"
"As I said, until the proper time comes, we're lying low, gathering herbs, hunting, doing things like that. I share a house with the other two men."
"Now that you mention it, what became of them?"
"They're probably still drinking. Every time we go there, they get drunk, and I wind up lugging them home. Tonight I decided to just leave them. Watch out! There's a sharp drop there. Stream down below. It's dangerous."
"Do we cross the stream?"
"Yes. It's narrow here, and there's a log across it just below us. After we cross, we turn right and climb up along the riverbank."
Musashi sensed that the man had stopped walking, but he did not look back. He found the log and started across.
A moment later, the man leaped forward and lifted the end of the log in an attempt to throw Musashi into the stream.
"What are you up to?"
The shout came from below, but the man jerked his head upward in astonishment. Musashi, having anticipated his treacherous move, had already jumped from the log and lit as lightly as a wagtail on a large rock. His startled attacker dropped the log into the stream. Before the curtain of flying water had fallen back to earth, Musashi had jumped back onto the bank, sword unsheathed, and cut his assailant down. It all happened so quickly that the man did not even see Musashi draw. The corpse wriggled for a moment or two before subsiding into stillness. Musashi did not deign to give it a glance. He had already taken a new stance in preparation for the next attack, for he was sure there would be one. As he steeled himself for it, his hair stood up like an eagle's crown feathers. A short silence ensued, followed by a boom loud enough to split the gorge asunder. The gunshot seemed to have come from somewhere on the other side. Musashi dodged, and the well-aimed slug hissed through the space he had been occupying, burying itself in the embankment behind him. Falling as though wounded, Musashi looked across to the opposite side, where he saw red sparks flying through the air like so many fireflies. He could just make out two figures creeping cautiously forward. A cleansing fire. Clenching his teeth tightly on the sputtering fuse, the man made ready to fire his musket again. His confederate crouched down and, squinting into the distance, whispered, "Do you think it's safe?"
"I'm sure I got him with the first shot," came the confident reply.
The two crept cautiously forward, but no sooner had they reached the edge of the bank than Musashi jumped up. The musketeer gasped and fired, but lost his balance, sending the bullet uselessly skyward. As the echo reverberated through the ravine, both men, the other two from the tea house, fled up the path. Suddenly, one of them stopped in his tracks and roared,
"Wait! What are we running for? There's two of us and only one of him. I'll take him on and you can back me up."
"I'm with you,"
shouted the musketeer, letting go of the fuse and aiming the butt of his weapon at Musashi. They were definitely a cut above ordinary hoodlums. The man Musashi took to be the leader wielded his sword with genuine finesse. Nonetheless, he was a poor match for Musashi, who sent them both flying through the air with a single sword stroke. The musketeer, sliced from shoulder to waist, fell dead to the ground, his upper torso hanging over the bank as if by a thread. The other man sped up the slope, clutching a wounded forearm, with Musashi in hot pursuit. Showers of dirt and gravel rose and fell in his wake. The ravine, Buna Valley, lay midway between Wada and Daimon Passes, and took its name from the beech trees that seemed to fill it. On its highest point stood an exceptionally large mountaineer's cabin, surrounded by trees, and itself crudely fashioned of beech logs. Scrambling rapidly toward the tiny flame of a torch, the bandit shouted,
"Douse the lights!"
Protecting the flame with an outstretched sleeve, a woman exclaimed,
"Why, you... Oh, you're covered with blood!"
Shut up, you fool! Put out the lights! The ones inside, too!"
He could hardly get the words out from panting, and with a last look behind him, he hurtled past her. The woman blew out the torch and rushed after him. By the time Musashi arrived at the cabin, not a trace of light was visible anywhere.
"Open up!" he bellowed.
He was indignant, not for being taken to be a fool, nor because of the cowardly attack, but because men like these daily inflicted great harm on innocent travelers. He might have broken open the wooden rain shutters, but rather than make a frontal attack, which would have left his back dangerously exposed, he cautiously kept a distance of 4 or 5 feet.
"Open up!"
Getting no answer, he picked up the largest rock he could handle and hurled it at the shutters. It struck the crack between the two panels, sending both the man and the woman reeling into the house. A sword flew out from beneath them and was followed by the man crawling on his knees.
He quickly regained his feet and retreated into the house. Musashi bounded forward and seized him by the back of his kimono.
"Don't kill me! I'm sorry!"
pleaded Gion Toji, his whining tone exactly that of a petty crook. He was soon back on his feet again, trying to find Musashi's weak point. Musashi parried each of his moves, but when he pressed forward to hem in his opponent, Toji, mustering all his strength, pulled his short sword and made a powerful thrust. Dodging adroitly, Musashi swept him up in his arms and with a cry of contempt sent him crashing into the next room. Either an arm or a leg struck the pot hanger, for the bamboo pole from which it hung broke with a loud crack. White ashes billowed up from the hearth like a volcanic cloud. A barrage of missiles coming through the smoke and ashes kept Musashi at bay. As the ashes settled, he saw that his adversary was no longer the bandit's chief, who was flat on his back near the wall. The woman, between curses, was throwing everything she could lay her hands on. Pot lids, kindling, metal chopsticks, tea bowls. Musashi leapt forward and quickly pinned her to the floor, but she managed to pull a bodkin from her hair and take a stab at him. When he brought his foot down on her wrist, she gnashed her teeth, then cried out in anger and disgust at the unconscious Toji.
"Haven't you any pride? How can you lose to a nobody like this?"
Hearing the voice, Musashi abruptly drew in his breath and let her go. She jumped to her feet, grabbed up the short sword and lunged at him.
"Stop it, ma'am," said Musashi.
Startled by the oddly courteous tone, she paused and gaped at him.
"Why? It's Takezo!"
His hunch was right. Apart from Osugi, the only woman who could still call him by his childhood name was Oko.
"It is Takezo!"
she exclaimed, her voice growing syrupy.
"Your name's Musashi now, isn't it? You've become quite a swordsman, haven't you?"
"What are you doing in a place like this?"
"I'm ashamed to say.
Is that man lying over there your husband?"
"You must know him. He's what's left of Gion Toji."
"That's Toji?" murmured Musashi.
He had heard in Kyoto what a reprobate Toji was, and how he had pocketed the money collected to enlarge the school and absconded with Oko. Still, as he looked at the human wreck by the wall, he couldn't help feeling sorry for him.
"You'd better tend to him," he said. "If I'd known he was your husband, I wouldn't have been so rough with him."
"Oh, I want to crawl in a hole and hide," simpered Oko.
She went to Toji's side, gave him some water, bound his wounds, and when he had begun to come around, told him who Musashi was.
"What?"
he croaked.
"Miyamoto Musashi? The one who... Oh, this is awful."
Placing his hands over his face, he doubled up abjectly. Forgetting his anger, Musashi allowed himself to be treated as an honored guest. Oko swept the floor, tidied up the hearth, put on new kindling, and heated some sake. Handing him a cup, she said, in accordance with the accepted rules of etiquette,
"We haven't a thing to offer, but..."
"I had quite enough at the tea house," Musashi replied politely. "Please, don't go to any trouble."
"Oh, I hope you can eat the food I've prepared. It's been such a long time."
Having hung a pot of stew on the pot hanger, she sat down beside him and poured his sake.
"It reminds me of old times at Mount Ibuki," said Musashi amiably.
A strong wind had come up, and though the shutters were again securely in place, it came in through various cracks and teased the smoke from the hearth as it rose to the ceiling.
"Please don't remind me of that," said Oko. "But tell me, have you heard anything of Akemi? Do you have any idea where she is?"
"I heard she spent several days at the inn on Mount Hiei. She and Matahachi were planning to go to Edo. Seems she ran away with all his money."
"Oh," said Oko disappointedly. "Her too?"
She gazed at the floor, sadly comparing her daughter's life with her own. When Toji had recovered sufficiently, he joined them and begged Musashi's forgiveness. He He had, he avowed, acted on a sudden impulse, which he now deplored. There would come a day, he assured his guest, when he would re-enter society as the Gion Toji the world had known before. Musashi kept quiet, but he would have liked to say that there didn't seem to be much to choose from between Toji the samurai and Toji the bandit. But if he did return to the life of a warrior, the roads would be that much safer for travelers. Somewhat mellowed by the sake, he said to Oko, "I think you'd be wise to give up this dangerous way of life."
"You're quite right. But of course, it's not as though I'm living this way out of choice. When we left Kyoto, we were going to try our luck in Edo. But in Sua, Toji got to gambling and lost everything we had. Travel money, everything. I thought of the moksa business, so we started gathering herbs and selling them in the town. Oh, I've had enough of this get-rich-quick schemes to last a lifetime. After tonight, I'm through."
As always, a few drinks had introduced a coquettish note into her speech. She was beginning to turn on the charm. Oko was one of those women of indeterminate age, and she was still dangerous. A house cat will romp coyly on its master's knees so long as it is well fed and cared for. But turn it loose in the mountains, and in no time it will be prowling the night with flaming eyes, ready to feast off a corpse or tear the living flesh off travelers who have fallen sick by the wayside. Oko was very much like that.
"Toji," she said lovingly, "according to Takezo, Akemi was headed for Edo. Couldn't we go there too and live more like human beings again? If we found Akemi, I'm sure we'd think of some profitable business to go into."
"Well, maybe," was the unenthusiastic reply. His arms were wrapped pensively around his knees. Perhaps the implied idea, peddling Akemi's body, was a little raw even for him. Toji, after living with this predatory woman, was beginning to have the same regrets as Matahachi. To Musashi, the expression on Toji's face seemed pathetic. It reminded him of Matahachi. With a shudder, he recalled how he himself had once been enticed by her charms.
"Oko," said Toji, lifting his head. "It won't be long till daylight. Musashi's probably tired. Why don't you fix a place for him in the back room so he can get some rest?"
"Yes, of course."
With a tipsy sidelong glance at Musashi, she said,
"You'll have to be careful, Takezo. It's dark back there."
"Thanks. I could use some sleep."
He followed her down a dark corridor to the back of the house. The room seemed to be an addition to the cabin. It was supported by logs and projected out over the valley with a drop of about 70 feet from the outer wall to the river. The air was damp from the mist and the spray blowing in from a waterfall. Each time the groaning of the wind rose a trifle, the little room rocked like a boat. Oko's white feet retreated across the slatted floor of the outdoor hallway to the hearth room.
"Has he gone to sleep?" asked Toji.
"I think so,"
she replied, kneeling by his side. She whispered in his ear,
"What are you going to do?" "Go call the others." "You're going through with it?" "Absolutely. It's not just a matter of money. If I kill the bastard, I'll have taken revenge for the house of Yoshioka."
Tucking up the skirt of her kimono, she went outside. Under the starless sky, deep in the mountains, she sped through the black wind like a feline demon, her long hair streaming out behind. The nooks and crevices on the mountainside were not inhabited solely by birds and beasts. As Oko raced along, she made contact with more than 20 men, all members of Toji's band. Trained for night forays, they moved more quietly than floating leaves to a spot just in front of the cabin.
"Only one man? A samurai?
Does he have money?"
The whispered exchanges were accompanied by explanatory gestures and eye movements. carrying muskets and daggers and the type of lances used by boar hunters, a few of them surrounded the back room. About half went down into the valley, while a couple stopped halfway down, directly below the room. The floor of the room was covered with reed mats. Along one wall were neat little piles of dried herbs and a collection of mortars and other tools used to make medicine. Musashi found the pleasant aroma of the herbs soothing. It seemed to beckon him to close his eyes and sleep. His body felt dull and swollen to the tips of his extremities. But he knew better than to give in to the sweet temptation. He was aware there was something afoot. The herb gatherers of Mimasaka never had storage sheds like this. Theirs were never located where dampness accumulated, and were always at some distance from dense foliage. By the dim light of a small lamp resting on a mortar stand beside his pillow, he could see something else that disturbed him. The metal brackets holding the room together at the corners were surrounded by numerous nail holes. He could also discern fresh wooden surfaces that must previously have been covered by joinery. The implication was unmistakable. The room had been rebuilt, probably a number of times. A tiny smile came to his lips, but he did not stir.
"Takezo?" Oko called softly. "Are you asleep?"
Gently sliding the shoji aside, she tiptoed to his pallet and placed a tray near his head.
"I'll put some water here for you," she said.
He gave no sign of being awake. When she was back in the cabin itself, Toji whispered,
"Is everything all right?"
Closing her eyes for emphasis, she replied,
"He's sound asleep."
With a satisfied look, Toji hurried outside, went to the back of the cabin and waved a lighted musket fuse, whereupon the men below pulled the supports out from under the room, sending it crashing down into the valley. Walls, frame, ridgepole, and all. With a triumphant roar, the others sprang from their hiding places, like hunters from behind portable blinds, and rushed down to the riverbank. The next step was to extricate the corpse and the victim's belongings from the debris. After that, it would be a simple matter to gather up the pieces and rebuild the room. The bandits jumped into the pile of planks and posts like dogs falling on bones. Arriving from above, others asked,
"Have you found the body?"
"No, not yet."
"It's got to be here somewhere,"
Toji shouted raucously.
"Maybe he struck a rock or something on the way down and bounced off to the side. Look all around."
Rocks, water, the trees, and plants of the valley were taking on a bright reddish cast. With startled exclamations, Toji and his henchmen looked toward the sky. 70 feet above, bright flames spouted from the doors, windows, walls, and roof of the cabin. It had turned into a huge ball of fire.
"Quick! Hurry! Get back up here!"
The piercing summons came from Oko and sounded like the howl of a woman gone mad. By the time the men had made their way up the cliff, the flames were dancing wildly in the wind. Unprotected from the shower of sparks and embers, Oko stood tied securely to a tree trunk. To a man, they were dumbfounded. Musashi gone? How? How could he conceivably have outwitted them all? Toji lost heart. He did not even send his men in pursuit. He had heard enough about Musashi to know they'd never catch him. On their own, however, the bandits quickly organized search parties and flew off in all directions. They found no trace of Musashi. Playing with Fire. Unlike the other principal routes, there were no trees lining the Koshu High Road, which joined Shiojiri and Edo by way of Kai Province. Used for military transport during the 16th century, it lacked the Nakasendo's network of back roads and had only recently been upgraded to the status of a main artery. For travelers coming from Kyoto or Osaka,
Its least agreeable feature was a dearth of good inns and eating places. A request for a box lunch was likely to bring forth nothing more appetizing than flat rice cakes wrapped in bamboo leaves, or, even less appealing, balls of plain rice done up in dried oak leaves. Despite the primitive fare, probably not much different from that of the Fujiwara period hundreds of years earlier, the rustic hostelries swarmed with guests, most of them bound for Edo. A group of travelers was taking a rest above Kobotoke Pass. One of them exclaimed, "Look, there's another batch," referring to a sight he and his companions had been enjoying almost daily, a group of prostitutes on their way from Kyoto to Edo. The girls numbered about 30, some old, some in their 20s or early 30s, at least 5 in their middle teens. Together with about 10 men who managed or served them, they resembled a large patriarchal family. There were in addition several pack horses loaded down with everything from small wicker baskets to man-sized wooden chests. The head of the family, a man of about 40, was addressing his girls.
"If your straw sandals are giving you blisters, change into zori, but tie them tight so they don't slip around. And stop complaining that you can't walk any farther. Just look at the children on the road. The children!"
It was clear from his acid tone that he was having a hard time forcing his usually sedentary charges to keep moving. The man, whose name was Shoji Jinnai, was a native of Fushimi, a samurai by birth who had for reasons of his own abandoned the military life to become a brothel keeper. Being both quick-witted and resourceful, he had succeeded in gaining the support of Tokugawa Ieyasu, who often took up residence at Fushimi Castle, and had not only obtained permission to move his own business to Edo, but had also persuaded many of his colleagues in the trade to do likewise. Near the crest of Kobotoke, Jinnai brought his procession to a halt, saying,
"It's still a little early, but we can have our lunch now."
Turning to Onao, an old woman who functioned as a sort of mother hen, he ordered her to pass out the food. The basket containing the box lunches was duly unloaded from one of the horses, and a leaf-wrapped ball of rice dealt out to each of the women, who scattered themselves about and relaxed. The dust that had yellowed their skin had also turned their black hair nearly white, though they wore broad-brimmed traveling hats or had tied hand towels around their heads. There being no tea, eating entailed a good deal of lip-smacking and tooth-sucking. There was no suggestion of sexual wiles or amorous thrills. "Whose arms will embrace this red, red blossom tonight?" seemed utterly beside the point.
"Oh, this is delicious," cried one of Jinnai's younger charges ecstatically.
Her tone of voice would have brought tears to her mother's eyes. The attention of two or three others wandered from their lunch to focus on a young samurai passing by.
"Isn't he handsome?" whispered one.
Not bad," replied another of more worldly outlook. A third volunteered, "Oh, I know him. He used to come to our place with men from the Yoshioka school."
"Which one are you talking about?" asked one lustful-eyed creature.
"The young one, strutting along there with a long sword on his back."
Unaware of the admiration, Sasaki Kojiro was pushing his way through a throng of porters and pack horses. A high, flirtatious voice called,
"Mr. Sasaki! Over here! Mr. Sasaki!"
Since there were lots of people named Sasaki, he didn't even turn.
"You, with the forelock!"
Kojiro's eyebrows shot up, and he spun around.
"Watch your tongues!" Jinnai shouted angrily. "You're being rude!"
Then, glancing up from his lunch, he recognized Kojiro.
"Well, well," he said, rising quickly. "If it isn't our friend Sasaki, where are you headed, if I may ask?"
"Why, hello! You're the master of the Sumiya, aren't you? I'm going to Edo.
And what about you? You seem to be engaged in a full-scale move." "That we are. We're moving to the new capital."
"Really?
Do you think you can make a go of it there?" "Nothing grows in stagnant waters."
The way Edo's growing, I imagine there's plenty of work for construction workers and gunsmiths, but elegant entertainment? It seems doubtful there's much demand for it yet.
You're wrong, though. Women made a city out of Osaka before Hideyoshi got around to taking any notice of it.
Maybe, but in a place as new as Edo, you probably won't even be able to find a suitable house.
Wrong again.
The government set aside some marshland in a place called Yoshiwara for people in my business. My associates have already started filling it in, putting in streets and building houses. From all reports, I should be able to find a good street front location fairly easily.
You mean the Tokugawas are giving the land away?
For free?
Of course. Who'd pay for marshland?
The government's even providing some of the construction materials.
I see. No wonder you're all abandoning the Kyoto area.
And what about you? Or do you have some prospect of a position with a daimyo?
Oh, no. Nothing like that. I wouldn't take one if it was offered. I just thought I'd see what's going on up there, since it's the shogun's residence and the place where orders are going to come from in the future. Of course, if I were asked to be one of the shogun's instructors, I might accept.
Though no judge of swordsmanship, Jinnai had a good eye for people. Thinking it just as well not to comment on Kojiro's unbridled egotism, he averted his eyes and began prodding his troop into movement.
Everybody up now! It's time we were going!
Onao, who had been counting heads, said,
We seem to be missing one girl. Which one is it now? Kicho? Or maybe Sumizome? No, they're both over there. This is strange. Who could it be?
Kojiro, disinclined to have a party of prostitutes for traveling companions, went on his way. A couple of the girls who had gone back down the road to search returned to where Onao was. Jinnai joined them.
Here, Onao, which one is it?
Ah, I know now. It was that girl named Akemi, she replied contritely, as if the fault were hers. The one you picked up on the road in Kiso.
She must be around here somewhere.
We've looked everywhere. I think she must have run away.
Well, I didn't have a written commitment from her, and I didn't lend her any body money. She said she was willing, and since she was good-looking enough to be marketable, I took her on. I suppose she's cost me a bit in traveling expenses, but not enough to worry about. Never mind her. Let's get moving.
He began hustling his group along. Even if it meant traveling after sundown, he wanted to reach Hachioji within the day. If they could get that far before stopping, they could be in Edo the next day. A short way down the road, Akemi reappeared and fell in with them.
"Where have you been?" Onao demanded angrily. "You can't just wander off without telling anyone where you're going. Unless, of course, you're planning to leave us."
The old woman went on to explain self-righteously how they had all been so worried about her.
"You don't understand," said Akemi, from whom the scolding brought nothing but giggles. "There was a man I know on the road, and I didn't want him to see me. I ran into a clump of bamboo, not knowing there was a sudden drop-off there. I slid all the way down to the bottom."
She corroborated this by holding up her torn kimono and a skinned elbow. But all the time she was begging forgiveness, her face showed not the slightest sign of contrition. From his position near the front, Jinnai caught wind of what had happened and summoned her. Sternly, he said,
"Your name's Akemi, isn't it?"
"Akemi, that's hard to remember. If you're really going to succeed in this business, you'll have to find a better name. Tell me, have you really resolved to go through with this?"
"Does it require resolution to become a whore?"
"It's not something you can take up for a month or so and then quit. And if you become one of my girls, you'll have to give the customers what they ask for, like it or not. Don't make any mistake about that."
"What difference does it make now? Men have already made a mess of my life."
"That's not the right attitude at all.
Now, you give this some careful thought. If you change your mind before we reach Edo, that's all right. I won't ask you to pay me back for your food and lodging."
That same day, at the Yakuoin in Takao, an older man, apparently free of the pressures of business, was about to resume his leisurely journey. He, his servant, and a boy of about 15 had arrived the previous evening and requested overnight accommodations. He and the boy had been touring the temple grounds since early morning. It was now about noon.
"Use this for roof repairs or whatever is necessary," he said, offering one of the priests 3 large gold coins.
The head priest, immediately apprised of the gift, was so overwhelmed by the donor's generosity that he personally hastened out to exchange greetings.
"Perhaps you would like to leave your name?" he said.
Another priest, saying this had already been done, showed him the entry in the temple registry, which read, "Daizo of Narai, dealer in herbs, resident at the foot of Mount Ontake in Kiso." The head priest apologized profusely for the poor quality of the fare served by the temple, for Daizo of Narai was known throughout the country as a lavish contributor to shrines and temples. His gifts always took the form of gold coins, in some cases, it was said, as many as several dozen. Only he himself knew whether he did this for amusement, to acquire reputation, or out of piety. The priest, eager to have him stay longer, begged him to inspect the temple's treasures, a privilege accorded to few.
"I'll be in Edo a while," said Daizo. "I'll come to see them another time."
"By all means, but at least let me accompany you to the outer gate," insisted the priest. "Are you planning to stop in Fuchu tonight?"
"No, Hachioji."
"In that case, it'll be an easy trip."
"Tell me, who's the lord of Hachioji now?"
"It's recently been put under the administration of Ookubo Nagayasu."
"He was a magistrate of Nara, wasn't he?"
"Yes, that's the man. The gold mines on Sado Island are also under his control. He's very rich."
"A very able man, it would appear."
It was still daylight when they came to the foot of the mountains and stood on the busy main street of Hachioji, where reportedly there were no fewer than 25 inns.
"Well, Jotaro, where shall we stay?"
Jotaro, who had stuck to Daizo's side like a shadow, let it be known in no uncertain terms that he preferred anywhere as long as it's not a temple. Choosing the largest and most imposing inn, Daizo entered and requested a room. His distinguished appearance, together with the elegant lacquered traveling case his servant carried on his back, made a dazzling impression on the head clerk, who said fawningly,
"You're stopping quite early, aren't you?"
Inns along the high roads were accustomed to having hordes of travelers tumble in at dinner time or even later. Daizo was shown to a large room on the first floor, but shortly after sundown, both the innkeeper and the head clerk came to Daizo's room.
"I'm sure it's a great inconvenience," the innkeeper began abjectly, "but a large party of guests has come in very suddenly. I'm afraid it'll be terribly noisy here. If you wouldn't mind moving to a room on the second floor?"
"Oh, that's perfectly all right," replied Daizo good-naturedly. "Glad to see your business is thriving."
Signaling Skeichi, his servant, to take care of the luggage, Daizo proceeded upstairs. He had no sooner left the room than it was overrun by women from the sumiya. The inn wasn't just busy, it was frenetic. What with the hubbub downstairs, the servants did not come when called. Dinner was late, and when they had eaten, no one came to clear away the dishes. On top of that, there was the constant tramping of feet on both floors. Only Daizo's sympathy for the hired help kept him from losing his temper. Ignoring the litter in the room, he stretched out to take a nap, using his arm for a pillow. After only a few minutes, a sudden thought came to him, and he called Skeichi. When Skeichi failed to materialize, Daizo opened his eyes, sat up and shouted,
"Jotaro! Come here!"
But he too had disappeared. Daizo got up and went to the veranda, which he saw was lined with guests, excitedly gaping with delight at the prostitutes on the first floor. Spying Jotaro among the spectators, Daizo swiftly yanked him back into the room. With a forbidding eye, he demanded,
What were you staring at? The boy's long wooden sword, which he did not take off even indoors, scraped the tatami as he sat down.
Well, he said, everyone else is looking.
And just what are they looking at?
Oh, there are a lot of women in the back room downstairs.
Is that all?
Yes.
What's so entertaining about that?
The presence of the whores didn't bother Daizo, but for some reason he found the intense interest of the men gawking at them annoying.
I don't know,
replied Jotaro honestly.
I'm going for a walk around town, Daizo said. You stay here while I'm gone.
Can't I go with you?
Not at night.
Why not?
As I told you before, when I go for a walk, it's not simply to amuse myself.
Well, what's the idea then?
It has to do with my religion.
Don't you get enough of shrines and temples during the daytime? Even priests have to sleep at night.
Religion has to do with more than shrines and temples, young man. Now go find Skeichi for me. He has the key to my traveling case.
He went downstairs a few minutes ago. I saw him peeking into the room where the women are.
Him too? Exclaimed Daizo with a click of his tongue. Go get him, and be quick about it.
After Jotaro had left, Daizo began retying his obi. Having heard the women were Kyoto prostitutes, famous for their beauty and savoir-faire, the male guests were unable to leave off feasting their eyes. Skeichi was so absorbed with the sight that his mouth was still hanging open when Jotaro located him.
Come on, you've seen enough,
snapped the boy, giving the servant's ear a tug.
Ouch,
squealed Skeichi.
Your master's calling you.
That's not true.
It is too. He said he was going for a walk. He's always taking walks, isn't he? Eh? Oh, all right,
said Skeichi, tearing his eyes away reluctantly.
The boy had turned to follow him when a voice called,
Jotaro? You're Jotaro, aren't you?
The voice was that of a young woman. He looked around searchingly. The hope that he would find his lost teacher and Otsu never left him.
Could it be?
He peered tensely through the branches of a large evergreen shrub.
Who is it?
Me.
The face that emerged from the foliage was familiar.
Oh, it's only you.
Akemi slapped him roughly on the back.
You little monster! And it's been such a long time since I saw you. What are you doing here?
I could ask you the same question.
Well, Oh, it wouldn't mean anything to you anyway.
Are you traveling with those women?
I am, but I haven't made up my mind yet.
Made up your mind about what?
Whether to become one of them or not,
she replied with a sigh. After a long pause, she asked,
What's Musashi doing these days?
This, Jotaro perceived, was what she really wanted to know. He only wished he could answer the question.
Otsu and Musashi and I, we got separated on the high road.
Otsu? Who's she?
She had hardly spoken before she remembered.
Oh, never mind. I know. Is she still chasing after Musashi?
Akemi was in the habit of thinking of Musashi as a dashing shugyosha, wandering about as the mood suited him, living in the forest, sleeping on bare rocks. Even if she succeeded in catching him, he'd see right away how dissolute her life had become and shun her. She had long since resigned herself to the idea that her love would go unrequited. But the mention of another woman awoke feelings of jealousy and rekindled the dying embers of her amorous instinct.
Jotaro, she said. There are too many curious eyes around here. Let's go out somewhere.
They left via the garden gate. Out in the street, their eyes were regaled by the lights of Hachioji and its 25 hostelries. It was the liveliest town either had seen since leaving Kyoto. To the northwest rose the dark, silent forms of the Chichibu Range and the mountains marking the boundary of Kai Province. But here the atmosphere was replete with the aroma of sake, noisy with the clinking of weavers' reeds, the shouts of market officials, the excited voices of gamblers, and the dispirited whining songs of local street singers.
I often heard Matahachi mention Otsu.
Akemi lied.
What kind of person is she?
She's a very good person, Jotaro said soberly. Sweet and gentle and considerate and pretty. I really like her. The threat Akemi felt hanging over her grew heavier, but she cloaked her feelings with a benign smile.
Is she really so wonderful?
Oh, yes, and she can do anything. She sings, she writes well, and she's good at playing the flute. Now visibly ruffled, Akemi said,
I don't see what good it does a woman to be able to play the flute.
If you don't, you don't. But everybody, even Lord Yagyu's Sekishusai, speaks highly of Otsu. There's only one little thing I don't like about her.
All women have their faults. It's just a question of whether they honestly admit to them, the way I do, or try to hide them behind a ladylike pose.
Otsu's not like that. It's just this one weakness of hers.
What's that?
She's always breaking into tears. She's a regular crybaby.
Oh? Why is that?
She cries whenever she thinks of Musashi. That makes being around her pretty gloomy, and I don't like it. Jotaro expressed himself with youthful abandon, heedless of the effect this might have. Akemi's heart, her whole body, was afire with raging jealousy. It showed in the depths of her eyes, even in the color of her skin. But she continued her interrogation.
Tell me, how old is she?
About the same.
You mean the same age as me?
But she looks younger and prettier. Akemi plunged on, hoping to turn Jotaro against Otsu.
Musashi's more masculine than most men. He must hate having to watch a woman carry on all the time. Otsu probably thinks tears will win a man's sympathy. She's like the girls working for the Sumiya.
Jotaro, very much irked, retorted, That's not true at all. In the first place, Musashi likes Otsu. He never shows his feelings, but he's in love with her. Akemi's flushed face grew bright crimson. She longed to throw herself into a river to quench the flames that were consuming her.
Jotaro, let's go this way.
She pulled him toward a red light in a side street. That's a drinking place.
Well, what of it?
Women have no business in a place like that. You can't go in there.
All of a sudden, I have the urge to drink, and I can't go in alone. I'd be embarrassed.
You'd be embarrassed? What about me?
They'll have things to eat. You can have anything you want.
At first glance, the shop seemed empty. Akemi walked right in, then, facing the wall rather than the counter, said,
Bring me some sake.
One cup after another went down as fast as was humanly possible. Jotaro, frightened by the quantity, tried to slow her down, but she elbowed him out of the way.
Quiet!
She yelped.
What a nuisance you are! Bring some more sake! Sake!
Jotaro, insinuating himself between her and the sake jar, pleaded,
You've got to stop! You can't go on drinking here like this! Don't worry about me, she slurred. You're a friend of Otsu's, aren't you? I can't stand women who try to win a man with tears. Well, I dislike women who get drunk. I'm so sorry, but how could a runt like you understand why I drink? Come on, just pay the bill. You think I've got money? Don't you? No. Maybe he can collect from the Sumiya. I've already sold myself to the master anyway.
Tears flooded her eyes.
I'm sorry. I'm really sorry.
Weren't you the one who was making fun of Otsu for crying? Look at yourself.
My tears aren't the same as hers. Oh, life's too much trouble. I might as well be dead.
With that, she stood up and lurched out into the street. The shopkeeper, having had other female customers like this in his time, merely laughed it off, but Aronin, who had until then been sleeping quietly in a corner, opened his bleary eyes and stared at her retreating back. Jotaro darted after her and grabbed her around the waist, but he lost his hold. She started running down the darkened street, Jotaro close behind.
Stop! He cried with alarm. You mustn't even think of it! Come back!
Though she seemed not to care whether she ran into something in the dark or fell into a swamp, she was fully conscious of Jotaro's pleading. When she had plunged into the sea at Sumiyoshi, she had wanted to kill herself, but she was no longer so lacking in guile. She got a certain thrill from having Jotaro so worried about her.
"Watch out!"
he screamed, seeing that she was headed straight toward the murky water of a moat.
"Stop it! Why do you want to die? It's crazy!"
As he caught her around the waist again, she wailed,
"Why shouldn't I die? You think I'm wicked. So does Musashi. Everybody does. There's nothing I can do but die, embracing Musashi in my heart. Never will I let him be taken from me by a woman like that."
"You're pretty mixed up. How did you get this way?"
"It doesn't matter. All you have to do is push me into the moat. Go ahead, Jotaro. Push!"
Covering her face with her hands, she burst into frenzied tears. This awakened a strange fear in Jotaro. He, too, felt the urge to cry.
"Come on, Akemi. Let's go back. Oh, I yearn so to see him. Find him for me, Jotaro. Please, find Musashi for me."
"Stand still. Don't move. It's dangerous."
"Oh, Musashi."
"Watch out!"
At that moment, the ronin from the sake shop stepped out of the darkness.
"Go away, boy," he commanded. "I'll take her back to the inn."
He put his hands under Jotaro's arms and roughly lifted him aside. He was a tall man, 34 or 35 years old, with deep-set eyes and a heavy beard. A crooked scar, no doubt left by a sword, ran from below his right ear to his chin. It looked like the jagged tear that appears when a peach is broken open. Swallowing hard to overcome his fear, Jotaro tried coaxing,
"Akemi, please come with me. Everything will be all right."
Akemi's head was now resting on the samurai's chest.
"Look," the man said, "she's gone to sleep. Off with you. I'll take her home later."
"No, let go of her."
When the boy refused to budge, the ronin slowly reached out with one hand and grabbed his collar.
"Hands off!"
screamed Jotaro, resisting with all his strength.
"You little bastard! How'd you like to get thrown into the moat?"
"Who's going to do it?"
He wriggled loose, and as soon as he was free, his hand found the end of his wooden sword. He swung it at the man's side, but his own body did a somersault and landed on a rock by the roadside. He moaned once, then remained still. Jotaro had been out for some time before he began hearing voices around him.
"Wake up there! What happened?"
Opening his eyes, he vaguely took in a small crowd of people.
"Are you awake?
Are you all right?"
Embarrassed by the attention he was attracting, he picked up his wooden sword and was trying to get away when a clerk from the inn grabbed his arm.
"Wait a minute," he barked. "What happened to the woman you were with?"
Looking around, Jotaro got the impression that the others were also from the inn, guests as well as employees. Some of the men were carrying sticks. Others were holding round paper lanterns.
"A man came and said you'd been attacked, and a ronin had carried the woman off. Do you know which way they went?"
Jotaro, still dazed, shook his head.
"That's impossible. You must have some idea."
Jotaro pointed in the first direction that came to hand.
"Now I remember. It was that way."
He was reluctant to say what really happened, fearing a scolding from Daizo for getting involved, but also dreading to admit in front of these people that the ronin had thrown him. Despite the vagueness of his reply, the crowd rushed off, and presently a cry went up,
"Here she is! Over here!"
The lanterns gathered in a circle around Akemi, whose disheveled form lay where she had been abandoned, on a stack of hay in a farmer's shed. Prodded back to reality by the clatter of running feet, she dragged herself to her feet. The front of her kimono was open. Her obi lay on the ground. Hay clung to her hair and clothing.
"What happened?"
While the word rape was on the tip of everyone's tongue, no one said it. nor did it even cross their minds to chase the villain. Whatever had happened to Akemi, they felt, she had brought on herself.
"Come on, let's go back," said one of the men, taking her hand. Akemi pulled away quickly. Resting her face forlornly against the wall, she broke down in bitter tears.
"Seems to be drunk. How'd she get that way?"
Jotaro had been watching the scene from a distance. What had befallen Akemi was not clear to him in detail, but somehow he was reminded of an experience that had nothing to do with her. The titillation of lying in the fodder shed in Koyagyu with Kocha came back to him, along with the strangely excited fear of approaching footsteps. But his pleasure quickly evaporated.
"I better get back," he said decisively.
As his pace quickened, his spirit, back from its trip to the unknown, moved him to break into song. "Old metal Buddha standing in the field, have you seen a girl of 16? Don't you know a girl who strayed? When asked, you say clang. When struck, you say bong." A cricket in the grass. Jotaro jogged along at a good pace, paying little attention to the road. Suddenly, he halted and looked around, wondering if he'd lost his way.
"I don't remember passing here before," he thought nervously.
Samurai houses fringed the remains of an old fortress. One section of the compound had been rebuilt to serve as the official residence of the recently appointed Ōkubo Nagayasu, but the rest of the area, rising like a natural mound, was covered with weeds and trees. The stone ramparts were crumbling, having been ravaged many years earlier by an invading army. The fortification looked primitive compared to the castle complexes of the last 40 to 50 years. There was no moat, no bridge, nothing that could properly be described as a castle wall. It had probably belonged to one of the local gentry in the days before the great civil war daimyo incorporated their rural domains into larger feudal principalities. On one side of the road were paddies and marshland, on the other, walls, and beyond, a cliff, atop which the fortress must once have stood. As he tried to get his bearings, Jotaro's eyes traveled along the cliff. Then he saw something move. Stop, and move again. At first it looked like an animal, but soon the stealthily moving silhouette became the outline of a man. Jotaro shivered, but stood riveted to the spot. The man lowered a rope with a hook attached to the top. After he had slid down the full length of the rope and found a foothold, he shook the hook loose and repeated the process. When he reached the bottom, he disappeared into a copse. Jotaro's curiosity was thoroughly aroused. A few minutes later, he saw the man walking along the low rises, separating the paddies, and apparently heading straight for him. He nearly panicked, but relaxed when he could make out the bundle on the man's back. What a waste of time! Nothing but a farmer stealing kindling! He thought the man must have been crazy to risk scaling the cliff for nothing more than some firewood. He was disappointed, too. His mystery had become unbearably humdrum. But then came his second shock. As the man strolled up the road past the tree Jotaro was hiding behind, the boy had to stifle a gasp. He was sure the dark figure was Daizo. "It couldn't be," he told himself. The man had a black cloth around his face and wore peasant's knickers, leggings, and light straw sandals. The mysterious figure turned off into a path skirting a hill. No one with such sturdy shoulders and buoyant stride could be in his 50s, as Daizo was. Having convinced himself that he was mistaken, Jotaro followed. He had to get back to the inn, and the man just might, unwittingly, help him find his way. When the man came to a road marker, he set down his bundle, which appeared to be very heavy. As he leaned over to read the writing on the stone, something about him again struck Jotaro as familiar. While the man climbed a path up the hill, Jotaro examined the marker, on which were carved the words, Pine Tree on Head-Burying Mound above. This was where the local inhabitants buried the severed skulls of criminals.